Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. You know what's really great? The smell of simmering food in your house. I mean, broths and braises sending their scent through the kitchen and into the living room. And, you know, my place is pretty small, so that also means that I get to fall asleep to the aroma of whatever is in my pot. If that sounds fun, great. And if it sounds even more like a way of passing through the winter emotionally intact, hey, even better. Because this episode is all about cold weather cooking. We've got a lesson in Korean-style bone broth, Siberian dumplings and pickle soup, and yes, I know this sounds impossibly weird, but chicken braised in chilies and chocolate milk. That was so delicious, I still can't believe it, but it's real. And first, beans. I love beans, dry beans, I mean. And honestly, more so since I became a dad. They're super nutritious. They keep forever in your pantry. They're so easy to cook, and they have so much flavor, they make their own broth when you boil them. I feel great whenever I have a pot of beans on my stove, and there's literally nothing I feel better about serving to my family. And Andy Baragani, one of the stars of Bon Appetit's Test Kitchen, is also a huge bean fan, and he's here to talk us through some of his great ideas. Hey, Andy.
Hi, Francis. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. So, you just heard me try to sell people a little bit on cooking beans. Because I really do
love them.
You don't
have to sell me, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
I'm also a bean lover.
But when you're coming up with recipes, like, are you nervous when you came up with something called brothy beans and farro? Like, does this not sound super sexy to most people?
I mean, it sounded really delicious to me. And I thought, like, there's something that I want to cook year-round, whether they're fresh shelling beans in the summer or dried beans in the fall and winter. And you can go so many different directions. And so that was something I wanted to do with this recipe.
Yeah. And, you know, you are from Northern California. So you have a little granola in your DNA, and that's fine because I'm right there with you, like, spiritually. Let's talk through this particular recipe, which you wrote back in February of 2018. And even though I know you like to riff off of it, so there are basically five parts of this dish, right? There's the beans,
yes,
and what you cook with them to make the broth, the grains, seared mushrooms, quick chili oil, and an egg yolk. So let's start with the beans. How do you like to do them?
So I typically take whatever kind of dry variety you have. I'll soak my beans in the refrigerator, drain that soaking liquid, and then I cover my beans probably by maybe 4 inches of water, cold water, fresh water. And then I season them at the very beginning lightly. And then from there, I kind of use whatever aromatics I really have on hand. In the recipe, I believe it's like a half a yellow onion. I leave the skin on because I think it gives a really nice, beautiful golden hue to the broth. Mm. A carrot for some sweetness, some kind of hard woody herb if I have it, like rosemary, sage, thyme, or fresh bay leaves. Mm. But I really do riff on the aromatics, like a fennel bulb, and then a hunk of some kind of dried, salty, cured meat. It could be salami or a piece of pancetta, sometimes mortadella. More herbs. If it's in the summer, I'll add like a really nice tomato or two, a head of garlic that just cut crosswise to expose its cloves.
Mm-hmm.
Citrus peels, I love adding, specifically lemon, and fat.
Yeah,
that can come in many different forms, whether that's the salted cured meat or olive oil. I'll do maybe like anywhere from half inch to an inch of olive oil to the beans. So that's quite a bit, but the beans need that fat. It's going to add a lot of flavor to the beans in the broth. And I just let it go really, really low and slow. I never want a rapid boil. I bring it up to maybe over medium-high heat, and then once I see a bubble or two, I'll turn it down really low, and I'll just stir every so often until the beans are very creamy and tender. Taste the broth, add a little more salt, and then at the very end, kind of, again, taste and adjust the seasoning. And then if you can, I kind of let the beans sit in that broth once they're done, just to really soak up any more of that flavorful infused liquid.
Yeah.
And then you have this incredible base broth that you could use for a soup on its own, and these beans that you can't even compare anything that you get from a can.
Yeah. Okay, so the next step in your recipe is you strain the beans out of the broth, keeping them both, and then you boil grains in that broth, in this case, farro.
Exactly. So I'll remove the beans because they've already cooked, and I'll set them aside, and then I'll add, I'm using farro here, but you could use really whatever grain you like. Barley would be delicious, spelt, really any kind of grain you like, and they're going to be cooking in this already really flavorful, aromatic broth.
Great. You put the beans back in, and that's what goes in your bowl, right? The beans, the farro, and then some of the broth.
Yeah, you have a lot of, you have this kind of, depending on the bean, like you'll have this, I keep saying gigante, but they're almost, they're creamy, but there's almost like, they're like, I have a fluffy interior to them, I find.
Like a really good potato or something.
Yeah, they are, exactly. And then you have the grain, which has like a little bit of bite. And then when you go really low and slow, that broth is just incredibly clear. It's not cloudy at all, and you kind of can just see everything together and the beans kind of melding and marrying with the grains.
And your topping. So you have you actually have three toppings. One is a crispy seared mushroom. How do you like to do those?
Yes, I go over the top with the garnishes, I guess. I like to use a mix of mushrooms just for kind of a texture and flavor. You don't have to. And what I'll do is rather than kind of slicing them or chopping them, I'll tear them. So if I'm using, I like maitake, oyster mushrooms, those are great, shiitake. And I'll just kind of tear them into kind of, I don't like saying bite-sized pieces because I think bite-sized pieces, I don't think people really know what that means.
My mouth is like a quarter inch to an
exactly. So I'll do anywhere from like an inch, inch and a half, 2 inches, and then kind of tear them, and they kind of become craggly pieces that when they brown, they get really kind of crisp and lacy around the edges, and I love that.
Love it.
So you have your mushrooms, your torn mushrooms, and then I'll heat a skillet with a generous amount of oil. Mushrooms are like sponges, so they do soak up quite a bit of oil, but I go medium-high heat. As soon as I see like just a whisper of smoke, I add the mushrooms. And I don't stir them at all. I just kind of let them sit undisturbed until they brown around the edges. And then once I see that they're starting to crisp around the edges, that's when I know I could turn them, give the pan a toss, and then until they're kind of all browned and crisp and kind of lightly charred all over the place.
So now we have the crispy mushroom. That's ready.
Crispy mushrooms. Once they're brown, I season them with some salt. They're ready to go. So that's one of the toppings.
Uh-huh.
And then the next thing is this chili oil, and we're at this place right now where there are just so many different chili oils out there.
Yeah.
To buy, to make, people are obsessed, and I mean for good reason. I've always I love it. It's one of those things that pretty much any restaurant I go to, I'll ask for hot sauce, chili oil, whatever, anything they have that adds some heat. So it's something like this dish where it's very earthy from the broth, the grains, the mushrooms. It's like it's kind of like a big hug. I wanted something to kind of add heat, something almost to kind of bring it back to life. Be almost a little bit like zippy.
Yeah.
And that's the chili oil. So it's a very simple chili oil. It's just made from fresh chilies. I use Fresnos, but you could use serranos, jalapenos, really whatever fresh chili you like. And that's combined with some garlic. You could chop it. You could thinly slice it. And then I combine that with some olive oil. And then I bring that up. And then once kind of the chilies begin to almost shrivel and the garlic begins to turn just kind of this pale golden color. I remove it off heat and add some chopped rosemary.
Oh, cool.
And just a little bit of rosemary. But it's like with the garlic and the chili and the oil, you're kind of like, okay, what direction, like what flavor profile is going to go? You have the garlic and chili, but the rosemary takes it to kind of this very kind of hearty, wintry place. Just a little bit of rosemary. I'm definitely sensitive to it.
Yeah.
Because it's so pungent. It does the trick. You're kind of just blooming the rosemary and extracting the oils from the herb.
Mm-hmm.
And it scents the entire oil, but not too much. And then I season that with a little bit of salt. And then I kind of just drape the whole dish with that oil.
Yeah. I love the idea of rosemary in the winter. It's like a little bit piney. You know, it just kind of feels like
exactly.
winter, right? And the last thing you do is an egg yolk.
Yeah, this is something that I tend to add egg yolks to dishes. Like, I definitely have a good amount of recipes where it's like I just add an egg yolk. And and I also know that a lot of people probably might not do that, but I add it to the dish because it adds this richness.
Mm.
You know, even if you have add a generous amount of olive oil to the cooking liquid for the beans and the grains, it's still like a very lean dish. There's not a tremendous amount of fat. So while you could add definitely like some grated Parmesan to this or any kind of hard salty cheese, I like the egg yolk because it kind of adds a richness to the broth that just takes it to a whole new place. And it's something that I picked up a while back. I feel like when I was traveling around Spain, I would see it in Madrid when I was in Basque Country, when I was in the Catalan region, you would see just eggs and mushrooms paired together a lot.
Yeah.
And also beans and eggs. So that's where it kind of came from, and I love the way it looks.
Yeah. So you just drop a raw egg yolk into the really hot bowl,
mm-hmm.
stir it in, and it really... And it makes it nice and creamy. It's a really
exactly.
great dish. I'm so glad you got to come in and talk with us about it in the studio. I had a chance to taste it with you that one time, and I can't stop thinking about it.
Oh, good, good, good.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you guys for having me.
Andy Baragani is senior food editor at Bon Appetit and one of the hosts at the Bon App YouTube channel. You can find his recipe for brothy beans and farro at splendidtable.org. And coming up, since we are talking about cold weather cooking, what's the food like in Siberia? I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Okay, so I am a sucker, right, for cookbooks from places that I don't know anything about. Which means I did a double take when I saw a stunning new book called Salt and Thyme, a cookbook of Siberian food. And, okay, I confess I know nothing about the cuisine of Siberia, and if I'm totally honest, there wasn't even much there to eat at all. But this book and its author, Alyssa Tomoshkina, have totally schooled me on how wrong that was. Alyssa, it's great to talk with you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So I have to tell you, when we first started thinking about doing this episode about cold weather cooking, it was really because I was looking at your beautiful book.
And oh,
I was
thank
thinking,
you.
No, truly. And I was thinking, well, Siberians probably know a little something about winter cooking.
yes.
But for those of us who don't know Siberia well or at all, what is something about the cuisine that would surprise us to learn?
I think... The really fascinating part is that people often think of Siberian food and Russian food in general as being Eastern European, which mm-hmm. is true. But if you look at the map and think in terms of the geography of Russia and where Siberia is situated, it's actually occupies a huge part of Asia. And mm-hmm. it's a really fascinating kind of crossroads between East and the West. So there's a lot more of Asian and Far Eastern influences in Siberian and Russian cuisine than generally kind of acknowledged.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you've also said to me that there's a beauty. You know, you think, oh my God, it's cold there all the time. What do they have to eat? They have nothing to eat. But you talk about it in terms of beauty, and there's a beauty in the rhythm of Siberian cooking and that you are thinking about winter all the time.
Definitely. I think these days, and rightly so, there's this return to you know, what's called slow living and seasonal living. And that's how we used to live for a very long time, definitely until the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, before imported foods were available. So you literally had to eat with seasons and eat what's available. And to me, that is a really beautiful way of connecting to the climate and connecting to the surroundings that you're in. And there's something really amazing about, you know, really cherishing the moment when you get your fresh produce and the magic of fermenting it, because that's really the only way you can preserve food in late summer and early autumn to last it until winter, when there's really hardly anything fresh available. And the idea of preservation is so essential to everyone's lifestyle, really. And that's why I felt that in the book, it was, you know, it occupies such a special part, including the title of the book as well, which is a reference to fermentation, because it's not only, you know, the ferment itself, it's also just the whole kind of philosophy and the whole lifestyle that is dictated by it.
Yeah, Salt and Thyme. It's a beautiful title. And, you know, they have such, there's such wonderful flavor in these fermented vegetables, right? And in the book, you have a recipe that uses like sour cucumber pickles in a way that I've never seen before as the flavor base for a soup called rasolnik.
Yep.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
I absolutely love using ferments in cooking. When you add them into soups and stews, especially, even a tiny bit will just create this most incredible complexity to the flavor that was otherwise absent. Mm-hmm. And rasolnik, the word rasol is actually a word for fermentation brine or fermentation liquor.
Oh, right.
So rasolnik essentially is, you know, a soup that's made with the fermented
like
brine and
brine soup.
Yep, essentially brine soup. Yep. So it's a soup that's made with beef brisket. So you make a rich stock with brisket, and then you boil some barley with it as well. Mm-hmm. And you create a sofrito using onions, carrots, a bit of tomato paste, and then you grate some soured cucumbers into it.
That's
and
so
that
cool.
gives it the most amazing... I can't even have enough words to describe, but I guess it's umami. It's almost a bit sweet.
For sure.
It's it's just incredible. And you also add a bit of the fermentation liquor from the jar. Mm. And then you mix it all together with the barley and the beef. And also another kind of tang element comes at the end, where you add quite a lot of sour cream into the soup before you take it off the heat. So you also get this really wonderful creaminess, but then the sharpness from the cucumbers cuts through as well. So there's so much complexity, and yet again the ingredients are so simple.
Yeah, I could just imagine that with some good dark rye bread and
absolutely.
Oh God, that sounds so
good.
I want to ask you about another dish too. And this is truly the one Siberian dish that I had heard of before I read your book. Pelmeni. Pelmeni. Okay, they're these great little filled dumplings. First, I want to hear in your words how you describe the experience of eating a great plate of pelmeni.
It's definitely a winter dish, and I can almost immediately see my family kitchen back in Omsk in Siberia. I would have it in a big bowl with lots of butter. You melt the butter in it. And then you add lots of freshly ground pepper as well, and just eat as many as you can, really. It's such a fantastic dish.
Yeah. And for those of us who haven't had them, they're, pardon me for saying this, I don't want to play the whole, it's like this dish from this other culture, but they're a little bit like tortellini or like ravioli or
essentially
like, you know, like Chinese dumplings, filled dumplings.
Yeah. I think almost every culture has some form of a dumpling that's as their kind of national staple, and everyone cooks them. And I believe pelmeni actually do historically connect to the Chinese dumplings, and they came eventually made their way to Siberia through the Mongolian settlers. So there's definitely a connection between the Chinese dumplings and pelmeni.
Right on. Go,
so there
my
you go.
People.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm so excited that we're dumpling siblings now.
Yes.
But it's interesting you say this is also winter food, because, I mean, you can get flour and meat year-round. Why is this more common in winter?
They are quite filling, I guess, and quite rich, especially if you, you know, the way I've described it, you consume it with a lot of butter, or you can also mm-hmm. consume it with the stock in which you cook them. So it can be more of a soup dish. But also, it's a really beautiful dish that creates a ceremony when you make it. In many families, people have a pelmeni making kind of ritual or a party where the eating is not actually as important. The eating happens a lot later. So you would have several generations or friends get together around the table and they just make lots and lots of dumplings. It's a very therapeutic, you know, really beautiful kind of communal, almost like an arts and crafts experience. And then you would just freeze them. And it's such a wonderful dish that you could, you know, just pull out of your freezer and it cooks within 10 minutes, really. But also, not every family, especially during the Soviet days, would have a freezer or even mm-hmm. earlier before the Soviet days. But because it's so freezing, the temperatures go way below zero. You know, it's minus 20, sometimes minus 40. So just popping the pelmeni outside does the job. So if you have a, you know, a terrace or a balcony, some people just hang them in a bag outside the window. And there you go. It just freezes there.
Oh, my God. That's incredible. But I love that, though. I love it. It's not just the what's growing, what's not growing idea of seasonal eating, but also this communal element of, oh, this is when we gather. And the idea that providing for ourselves is something that's social, something we have to do as a group. We would not survive otherwise.
Absolutely.
So, Alyssa, you've mentioned a few things, you know, the technology of refrigeration and how not everyone had that for a long time, and the sort of isolation of Siberia, but it's also, you know, much more connected to other places than we might expect. This is a big question, but could you describe a way in which you've seen Siberian cuisine evolve or change?
Oh, this is such a fascinating question. And the historian in me really loves digging into the history of recipes and kind of charting the trajectory of how things have changed. I think the biggest change, obviously, was during the 20th century, between the pre-revolutionary and the Soviet regime, so in the early 1920s. And despite so many horrendous things that came with the Soviet regime, what I find really fascinating from a more kind of historical point of view is how the new Soviet regime saw food as a real important vehicle for them to implement this new sense of Soviet identity. And, you know, if you think of the former Soviet region, you know, it's a huge, huge part that goes, you know, all the way from Eastern Europe all the way to China. And it, you know, encompasses so many different nations and ethnic groups. And, you know, how do you put them all together and suddenly make them feel as if they belong to one community, one nation? And they did that obviously through culture, you know, music and literature and all of that. But food played such an important part for them as well. There was an actual, you know, department within the government that specifically looked into recipes and nutrition and menus. And they have created a almost like a standardized menu that was implemented in canteens and schools throughout the whole country. So they used a lot of the pre-revolutionary recipes that already existed and were familiar, but they've simplified them, you know, quite often lost the meat because obviously it was a very expensive ingredient, and made them uniform and published cookbooks and said that's the, you know, proper Soviet way to cook. And miraculously, it worked. And, you know, despite the problematic history of the Soviet Union, those recipes do hold a very, you know, we do hold them quite dearly in our hearts. And they, you know, they're cooked more or less the same by millions of people. And
it's a very interesting,
fascinating, kind of almost mysterious connection that we all have. So that's, you know, that's one way in which the food has, you know, transformed over time. But then obviously the collapse of the Soviet Union brought in a lot of imported foods, which again, you know, as I've said, we've lost that connection to the seasonality a lot. But, you know, it obviously comes as more kind of a global way of eating, you know, the first McDonald's opened in Moscow and so on. But at the same time, you know, it opened people's eyes to foreign cuisines. So in a way, there was something positive in that too. And more recently, another, you know, very problematic episode in recent Russian history with Crimea that brought on a whole load of sanctions from various Western countries, including the import of food. So all of a sudden, Russian food markets lost things like Italian cheeses, for example. And that's, for better or for worse, inspired this new flourishing of Russian farmers' markets, and Russian farmers started producing Italian cheeses.
So fascinating.
Russian mozzarella now, or Russian burrata, which, you know, when you first pick up the package and you see mozzarella produced in Russia, it kind of like, what? It just doesn't make any sense. It's so bizarre. But that's what's happening right now. And it's, you know, it's still quite early days. It's only been, you know, the last 5 years or so. So it would be very fascinating to see where that takes us. And perhaps in, I don't know, 20 years' time, people will think of mozzarella as a national staple as well.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much, Alyssa.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Alyssa Tomashkina is author of Salt and Thyme. You could find her recipes for that beef and pickled cucumber soup, rosolnik, and those dumplings, pelmeni, at splendidtable.org. Hey, you know what everyone needs? It's a video game playing, internet cooking video superstar Korean auntie. And if you didn't know you had one of those, well, you do. Her name is Emily Kim, better known as Mongchi, one of the biggest food stars on YouTube. Go ahead, check her out. I'll wait. Spicy rice cakes, 10 million views. Crunchy Korean fried chicken, 12 million views. She's gotten over a million views literally making white rice. She's been teaching the internet how to cook serious Korean food for over 12 years. And we are so happy to have her in the studio to talk about one of her favorite winter traditions, making creamy bone broth. Mongchi, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I know we want to talk about winter food, but I want to start by asking you something maybe a little bit funny. But okay, so there is this cold Korean noodle dish called naengmyeon.
Yeah.
Right. It's served in broth, often with ice cubes. And I remember the first time I saw it, I thought, oh my God, Korea has to be the hottest country on earth. And then I remember seeing all these Korean soups and stews served in these thick, black stone bowls that are so hot that the stew is on the table, basically boiling the entire time you're eating it. And then I thought, oh God, Korea must be the coldest place on earth. So is that true, or is it just... Do Korean people just really enjoy extreme temperatures in their food?
Yeah, I think I can say that. So you talk about naengmyeon, cold noodle soup.
Yes.
I love, crazy about cold noodles. I eat it during the cold winter time. So usually when I was young, I just put the blanket, hold my body, wrapping, and then cold noodle soup. Naengmyeon is my favorite. But mostly soup should be served really hot, bubbling, you know. So you talk about this earthenware bowl.
Yeah.
We call this tukbaegi, ongi. You know, it's made from clay.
Okay.
Anyway, we enjoy all the time. That it has to be hot. And even the summertime, we eat also really hot, bubbling soup. Everybody's sweating, you know, sweating, tickling. And then they feel so good after finishing one bowl. Because, you know, kind of relatively, you feel that really kind of a cold, cool.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay, so first of all, I think that's really interesting that it's not as a simple, oh, if it's cold outside, we eat hot food. If it's hot outside, we eat cold food. But you said in the wintertime, you do have special dishes that you like to make. Tell me about what
bone broth. Okay. So, you know, the ox bone, leg bone. And usually these days, it's, you can get it so easily everywhere, you know, ox bone.
Okay.
And then in case of me, I go to Korean market, and there is like a sliced, already prepackaged, sliced thinly. Like between half and 1 inch.
Just slices of the bone.
Yeah, so, but when I was young, my mom made it for whole family. So she used the real bones.
Yeah, like the whole thing.
Yeah, when I think about, oh my God, I'm so surprised even now, you know. But I remember she just used 3-4 bones and a huge pot. And
like a whole leg bone.
Yeah, whole leg bone. Sometimes there is like even still the hair is still there.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. Disgusting.
It's a real thing.
Yeah, my mom just boiled this like days and days.
Okay.
And then entire week, we keep eating morning, lunch, dinner. So in Korea, wife is making bone broth, and then husband is so afraid. Oh, where are you going? So they know their whole family see this. Okay, mom is making bone broth. Oh, she's going to go somewhere.
She's leaving you with the broth. You take care of yourself. This is going to take care of you.
Yeah. And you make rice and kimchi is in the refrigerator.
Okay.
So husband or even one of the children take out the side dishes and this broth will get reheat.
Amazing. So, the Korean bone broth is really interesting because, okay, when I go to like a fancy Western grocery store now, you see like bone broth in the freezer.
Yeah.
And I laugh because it's basically chicken stock or beef stock. Mm-hmm. It's just with a fancy name. But the Korean bone broth is very white, very milky.
Yeah.
And your recipe for it, the ingredient list is literally 4.5 pounds beef bones. There's no other ingredient.
Beef bone plus water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you get it that milky, creamy, rich?
Yeah. And first, I buy the bones and then soak in cold water and to remove the blood.
Okay.
So just for 1 hour and up to overnight and changing water.
Okay.
The pinky water just you have to pour out. And then a big pot, stock pot, and I bring to a boil and blanch these bones and maybe 10 minutes, for 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then a lot of it comes like bubbling, some brownish, impurities coming, floating.
Yeah.
And then I have to wash these bones again. And also the stock pot using, soapy water. And then everything's clean. And then I put the bones back into this stock pot again.
Yeah.
So I just boil this around in like 6 hours, over like medium low.
Okay.
Medium low kind of a simmer.
Okay.
This, and then the water is boiling down, right?
Yeah.
A little bit, so boiling off. And then I add water again.
Keep it covered.
And then, repeat this until I get the whole pot is full of white milky broth.
Mm.
So it takes around, 18 hours to 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And then just I take it out, and this milky broth, but on top, like a surface is like a full of some oil, the floating oil. Mm-hmm. So that's why this is the reason I like to make it in wintertime.
Okay.
Because refrigerators are full of vegetables, kimchi containers are occupied there. And then I need to make it cool down, this stock pot. So in the wintertime in my patio outside, the temperature is so cold. So I put this whole stock pot outside. Then the next morning, thick layer of fat is just like, thick.
Oh, just
solid.
On top.
Yeah, solid.
Yeah,
and
then
liquid is like white, milky, kind of gelatinous.
Yeah.
So that's bone broth. And then with bone broth, I can make all kind of stuff. I add fermented bean paste and some vegetables, and I make a nice flavor kind of a soup.
Yeah.
And also I eat by itself, just to reheat this.
Yeah.
And then just a
little salt
and chopped green onion and pepper, ground black pepper.
Oh, beautiful.
And, if you want, and you can add also garlic, minced garlic. Wonderful. The bowl of soup, and then I serve this earthenware bowl, the tukbaegi, and rice and kimchi. And then mix together and eat.
And it's such
yummy,
rich, comforting, nutritious feeling thing.
You can enjoy the real kind of bone marrow the flavor.
Yeah.
Really good. Yeah. Really good. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Cool. Thank you so much, Mangchi.
Oh, you're welcome.
Mangchi's latest book is Mangchi's Big Book of Korean Cooking. You can find her recipe for beef bone broth at splendidtable.org. And coming up later,
today we're going to make chicken cooked in chocolate milk.
That's Chef Tyler Cord. And look, I know, honestly, it sounds like a joke, but it was really great. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Chicago is truly one of the great restaurant cities in the country, and really in the world. And one of the great hometown hero chefs is Paul Kahan. His restaurants have won nine James Beard Awards, but anyone who knows him will tell you he's one of these chefs that just really loves to cook at home. No fuss, no stress, his vibe is just come hang and we'll make something good to eat. And his latest book is about exactly that. It's called Cooking for Good Times, and Sally Swift talked with him about great winter food.
Hey, Paul, so good to have you here.
Real pleasure.
So what do you love to cook when it gets cold outside?
You know, I think I'm no different than most people when it gets cold. I really gravitate towards braised meats. You know, I have my own version of pot roast, and I love to do oxtails and pair them with oily fish. Sounds crazy, but it's delicious. You know, I'm always wrapping up my garden in the yard when it gets cold, and there are a lot of roots in there, celery root and carrots and turnips and beets. And so I really enjoy cooking root vegetables in the fall and
you
winter.
You always have beets on your menu.
Yeah, I'm a beetaholic. Hi, my name is Paul. I'm a beetaholic.
So what can you tell us about your technique for roasting root vegetables?
You know, one of the things is you peel off a piece of the skin and you taste it. And if it tastes like shoe leather, I would recommend peeling the root vegetable. If it doesn't, leave it. You know, clean it. If it's a carrot, I mean, that's where all the nutrition is in most of them. And there are beets that have real thin skins, like golden beets oftentimes clean up really well. So leave the skins on and then cut them in a pleasing shape. Not too thick. Usually a beet will be cut into like in half and then to sort of like little pie wedges or little moons. And then we get a neutral oil really hot in a pan. Olive oil works, but we like to use toasted rice bran oil. It's something you can get at Asian markets. It's really good for you and has a really high flash point so it doesn't burn. And then when that pan's, you know, shimmery, you know, probably a tablespoon of oil, a little more than you'd think because the roots, when they get hot, they get porous and they start to absorb a little of that oil. And you do want a good coating there. But get the pan really hot and then dump your roots into that pan. And then I let them sit. People get really excited and they like to move stuff around and, you know. But really, you just add them to the pan. And if it seems like it's smoking hot crazy, you could turn it down to like a medium high. But get some color on them and then move them a little bit. I neglected to mention that we've preheated the oven to hot-ish, you know, 375, 400. And then the whole pan, well, at that point, I like to season it with salt and pepper, sort of a precursor seasoning. And oftentimes add either sugar or honey, and that's really the key for me. I feel like all roots have a little bit of a bitter edge to them, some more than others. But I'll add a little bit of sugar or a little bit of honey in that. And before I throw it in the oven, I throw a sprig of rosemary and thyme in there just for a little extra flavor.
Okay.
Not 100% necessary. And it you know, depending on the root, after 5 or 6 minutes, you pull them out and you stick a knife in it or you pull a chunk out as I do and blow on it and cool it and then taste it. As soon as they get tender to your liking, pull it back out, put it back on the stovetop, squeeze a little fresh orange juice on them or lemon juice, readjust the seasoning, and they're done. And they can cool. You could do those the day before. But, yeah, that's the way we do it.
And then what would you do to reheat them? You would just throw them back in the oven and heat them up and serve?
Yeah, exactly. Dump them onto a sheet tray or put them in a skillet and throw them in the oven for, you know, 5 or 8 minutes at a low temperature just to take the chill off of them. And they're good to go.
And does it really hold through to that second roasting, those flavors?
Oh, man. You know, the roots, when they hit that pan, like I said, they're porous and the pores open up. And as you cook them and caramelize them a little bit or even char them a little bit, they pick up all that flavor in the pan. And then, you know, it's amazing how the rosemary and thyme sprig, how that flavor comes through the oil and into the roots and the salt and pepper. And then, like I said, acidity is, maybe I didn't say it, but acidity is such a primary element of our cooking. You know, reminds me of a story at our restaurant, The Publican. We worked on this chicken dish. It's sort of the legendary dish there that everyone loves. And it's a spatchcock bird that we marinate with garlic and Mexican oregano and espalette pepper, lemon juice, lemon zest, olive oil, garlic, and we char on the grill and finish it in the oven. There's that technique again. But we tried like 10 different farm birds and a lot of different variations on the marinade, and we're like, this is really good, but what's going to make it great? And a young man named Brian Houston, who was the original chef de cuisine at that restaurant, said, let's just squeeze lemon juice out of it every time when it comes off the grill. And that little factor right there is like a major eureka in my cooking world. It's like, man, and I tell people at demos all the time, if you learn anything today, learn to squeeze lemon juice on everything, steak, fish, a salad. It'll just make it taste so much better and really brings all the flavors together for me.
Pulls it all together, no doubt.
Yeah.
So can you talk me through, you have a beautiful recipe in the book for roasted and marinated roots with smoky yogurt, crisp lentils, and dill vinaigrette.
Yeah, that's an easy one. The roots are something, again, that you would do ahead of time. And then the key components, I think, that make it sort of very chefy, but are not difficult at all, the crispy lentils. I tell the story in the book, a great, incredible chef friend of mine in Cleveland, Jonathan Sawyer, every time I see him, he's doing something. I'm like, man, where'd you come up with that? And I did this event with him, and he was serving a dish with crispy lentils on top. And he has this long technique. You know, you have to blanch the lentils and then cryovac them with olive oil and a ton of salt and then leave them in your fridge for a month. And then after that month, rinse them and then fry them, and they're delicious. But Perry Hendricks, the chef at Avec, I think in a pinch came up with the idea of you just soak them in water overnight. And we prefer the little beluga lentils,
yeah. But
French green lentils work really well. You just soak them in water overnight, drain them, and then in olive oil, you know, shallow in a pan, you crisp them up. You like really shallow fry them, barely a deep fry.
Mm-hmm.
And then you drain them and you season them with a little bit of cayenne pepper and salt.
Oh,
and they
that
become this
so amazing.
They become this nutty, crispy, you know, we're all about crispy bits.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's another thing like seasoning. Like if you have in your pantry some fried garlic, even the fried garlic that you purchase from, you know, Asian markets,
yeah.
or fried shallots, you have in your pantry all these different crispy bits. And you just finish a salad or a dish with some little accents of flavor, it takes it to a whole nother level. For this one, we do a vinaigrette with a little bit of microplaned jalapeno. Hmm. And a ton of dill.
And that dill is so green against those roots, those richly roasted roots. And then you
yeah.
add smoky yogurt. How do you do the smoky yogurt?
Yeah, smoky yogurt. You know, at Avec, we actually cold smoke the yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, man, this book is not about anything tricky like that.
Yeah.
You could do nothing to the yogurt except add a little lemon juice, salt and pepper,
mm-hmm.
and a splash of vinegar. And all of a sudden, yogurt becomes this comforter, this bedding. For any salad, you know, and it adds this great complexity. And I've always loved to combine something that's creamy, in this case yogurt, healthy with a vinaigrette, great contrast mm-hmm. of flavor, and really takes what you're doing to another level. But we just add either the
liquid smoke.
Yeah, but on a better level, there's a lot of great smoked sea salt out there.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I would recommend smoked sea salt. And a little bit of pepper and a little bit of lemon juice and vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we combine that with, I'm also a chicory freak. In this case, we use radicchio. And you just tear that up, combine it with the vinaigrette, you know, and the roots.
That just
put that to bed
like...
on top of a pool mm-hmm. of the yogurt and top it with the crispy lentils and something that's really, really special.
It is a beautiful, beautiful dish. What a pleasure it's been to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Paul Kahan is author of Cooking for Good Times. You can find his recipe for roasted and marinated roots with smoky yogurt, crisp lentils, and dill vinaigrette at splendidtable.org. Okay, so Tyler Cord is really one of my favorite people on earth. And I knew I wanted to turn to him this winter because he just wrote a whole cookbook called Dynamite Chicken. And what's better than a braised chicken? Now, a couple of years ago, I edited another one of his books called A Super Upsetting Cookbook About Sandwiches. It is honestly the funniest cookbook ever written, I guarantee it. And he, I found, has this bizarre superhero gift. He can make the most impossible-sounding food combinations delicious. He once made a mind-blowing mayonnaise that tastes just like a Vietnamese soup. His signature dish is a roasted broccoli sandwich with pickled lychees and ricotta salata cheese. But even after all that, when I found out that he actually wrote a recipe for chicken braised in chocolate milk, I thought, okay, Tyler, you have gone too far. And so I had to go over to his house and try it for myself. Chef Tyler Cord, thanks for having me in your home.
Thanks for coming.
So you are, how do I put this, nuts. And it's one of the reasons why you're one of my favorite people in the world. Todd, you're really going to make chicken cooked to chocolate milk?
Yeah, totally I'm going to do that. It's in the book already. It's been published.
It's been made before.
I wrote that recipe like 2 years ago. So yeah, like it's happening. You can't stop that ball
it's
from rolling.
It's already happened.
It seemed like a good idea. I don't know. I've done it. I had done it before. We used to do these Thanksgivings at the restaurant that were totally nuts. And then I would also cook like very traditional Thanksgiving stuff to pack up as leftovers for people so they could still have the actual Thanksgiving. But we would make, I would make crazy stuff. And one year I was like, for some reason.
It was like a buy one, get one Thanksgiving special?
Kind of, you know. It was your parting gift was, here's actual Thanksgiving. Sorry about that experiment that you just went through. But one year I was like, I want to cook this turkey in milk. I don't know why. I have weird whims. Yeah,
there's like pork cooking milk.
Yeah, it's not like a totally ludicrous thing, right? But so I was like, I want to cook some milk. And the more that I was thinking about it, I was like, well, what happens if I add a little chocolate to that? And it made me start thinking about mole, but I didn't want to make mole. I wanted to still poach turkey and milk, add a little chocolate. But then I was like, well, so if I take it to that in that direction, right? Mm-hmm. Turkey poached in milk, but I add a little bit of chocolate and then I add some chilies and I add some this and that. Then kind of steer it in that mole direction. Then maybe that somehow legitimizes the fact that I'm cooking turkey in what is essentially chocolate milk. So then when it was time to do this cookbook, I mean, I threw some really weird ideas at Food 52, many of which they shot down, but like they were into it for whatever reason. So,
but it's good. You can vouch for it.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. It's a really simple recipe.
I guess it smells really good in here.
Thank you.
I'm giving away the game a little bit because there is one already made that we're going to taste.
All right, so we have chicken.
This is an unusual move because what you've just done is you put the chicken in the pot, which I guess in itself is not
unusual. What's so unusual?
But the pot is sitting on your counter. The pot is not on your stove. I guess what I'm saying is you're not getting the pot hot, so the oil is shimmering, so you put this chicken skin side down to get a good crisp browning. You were literally just putting the chicken in a pot. Two jalapenos, sliced in half. Salt. Chili powder.
Yeah, that's just ancho chili powder. It's just ground dried ancho chilies, but...
Super.
I also have this one. You can make it with... Chili with an I or chili with an E. I think it says I in the book, but I think I meant the E one. It's going to be okay. What else?
Chocolate milk.
1 cup.
And there's 12 ounces in the bottle, so I get to have a little bit of snack.
And that's it. It's done.
Are you serious?
No, I'm going to cook it. What? But I mean, like, the setup is done.
That's it? You bring it to a boil?
Yeah, I'm going to bring it up and then simmer it. I'll turn it back down, you know? It'll simmer. It'll bubble a lot.
The chicken will cook, and then we're done?
Yeah, I'll flip it a couple times, because we didn't sear the skin, so it's not rendered at all. You could also just take the skin right off, if that offends you, or you could sear it first, but that just seems unnecessary to me.
So you
could take the skin off, or you can flip it a bunch of times, mostly cook it with the skin side down so that it does kind of render a little, and then it gets that, like, flabby boiled chicken thing, and I don't mind that. But if that bothers you, which I feel like people are weird about, soggy.
I think referring it to this flabby boiled chicken thing probably doesn't do a lot of favors, but I hear you.
I don't know. But I grew up with, you know, I grew up eating boiled chicken, I guess. My Hungarian family likes that kind of stuff.
So this is really it. You have the chicken, the chili powder, the chilies, salt, and chocolate milk. You bring it to a boil, you turn it down to a simmer, and 40 minutes later, it's done.
That's it. I mean, we could add other stuff if you want.
Okay. Should we taste it?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have to stand here for 40 minutes because you already cooked one.
Yeah. Let's plate it. Can I sneak in here real fast for a spoon? I'm so sorry. Oh, and you're going to need a knife and a fork and things.
So this does not look like I'm about to eat chocolate milk. This really looks like a beautiful brown savory sauce.
It's separated a little bit. It's not like... It's not like curdled milk.
Yeah, no. It looks great. I mean, that looks like a beautiful sauce. Let's cut into this guy.
Oh, it's cooked enough. I didn't check. That's great.
That's really good.
Right?
That's really good.
Thanks.
I can't believe how good it is.
The skin is nice like that, though, too, right? Like, you could totally render it more, but, like, I don't know. It's like the cap of fat on a steak, in a way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it adds a little...
I love that. It's actually a nice, juicy
texture.
It's a little bit chewy. It's like luscious and wonderful. And the sauce it does not taste like chocolate milk. I mean, there's like a sweetness in it, but it's spicy and super savory. And wow, this is delicious.
You want a spoon? There's a spoon. If you want to just taste the sauce. Because the chicken gives it a lot of flavor too, right? Like that's bone-in chicken. It's imparting its own chicken stocky good times. That was a horrible thing I just said, and I'm so sorry.
That was so, bro. That was so food TV bro of you.
Yeah, that was weird.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming. I'm glad you liked it. I'm sorry when we texted about it, it sounded so gross, because it is weird. But it's fun.
It's incredibly delicious.
It's super easy. Thanks.
Thank you.
Tyler Cord is the author of Food 52's Dynamite Chicken, 60 never-boring recipes for your favorite bird. I'm honestly still in shock that spicy chocolate milk simmered chicken is actually so good, and it is really the easiest dish I've made probably all year. And you can find the recipe for it at splendidtable.org. And with that, we'll say goodbye for the week, because really, where else can you go from there? I hope you enjoyed getting into some of the recipes that will keep us warm and full this winter. I hope you like cooking them as much as we like talking about them. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.